Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Let the filibustering begin.
It was the year of fire.
The year of destruction.
The year we took back what was ours.
It was the year of rebirth.
The year of great sadness.
The year of pain.
And the year of joy.
It was a new age.
It was the end of history.
It was the year everything changed.
The year is 2261. The place, Babylon 5.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Filibuster. My name is Charlene Schmidt, and with me is Philip Gilfus for the fourth installment of our six-part series on Babylon 5. We have been tackling each season one by one, and then we're going to keep doing so till we're done with the series. We'll take on the movies, and then it's going to be over. So we're more than through the halfway point now, Gilfus. How do you feel about that?
It's getting a little sad. I mean, you know, season four, which we're going to talk about, kind of comes at 100 miles per hour. And so you sort of have whiplash by the time you're over with it.
Truth.
And you almost feel like you're done, which I guess we'll get into that too. But then you're like, oh, wait, no, the season five. And then, oh, yeah, there are movies.
Right.
There's movies too. And so it's,
right.
It's not.
But wait, there's more.
Exactly. So it's not a letdown. There's more to go. But I don't want to spoil anything so far. But, you know, season four, there's stuff to look forward to in season five in the movies. But it's kind of a downhill from here. I don't mean that negatively. I just mean, like, you know, we've been to the pinnacle, and so now everything, there's a bunch left, and we're going to enjoy it, but it'll be soon to say goodbye to it all.
It's true. Like, once you get to season five, you kind of know that the story is starting to wrap up, and it is a little bit sad. But today we get to talk about the really fun part, because we are at the height of action in the Babylon 5 story. We have two wars going on. We have people dying. We have people coming back to life. We have civil wars going on more than one world. Not everybody is going to make out of it alive. Some people are lost only to be brought back and then only to be lost again. I mean, there's marriage. I mean, we have a lot of ground to cover.
Yes.
That's what I'm trying to really say. So why don't we just get into it? Because there's just so much going on in season four. The way that we're going to go about this is we're going to try and go as chronological as we can, but it is going to have to jump just a little bit because of the way things are threaded throughout the story. That said, let's just start with episode one and talk a little bit about Sheridan, because the last that we saw at the end of season three...
Jump!
Yeah, jump now! He jumped into this massive hole in the ground right before the White Star nuked Zaha Doom, and we have to presume that he's dead. And so season four actually starts out on this really kind of bleak downer of a note. I mean, Ivanova looks and is just acting like kind of like a zombie. Delenn is not eating. Things are not looking well on Babylon 5 right now.
Garibaldi's missing.
Yeah, where is Mr. Garibaldi? Oh my gosh. A lot of things going on here. So the badass ladies, as I call them, Lita, Delenn, and Ivanova, they decide that they have to go out looking for Sheridan in case there's any shred of a chance that he is still alive at Zaha Doom. And so Lita volunteers to use her telepathic abilities to try and see what's going on. They unfortunately don't have much luck. There's nothing there. So at the very end of... Well, no, not at the very end. Almost at the very end of the first episode, we're led to believe, oh, Sheridan really might be dead, but...
Dun-dun-dun-dun.
Yeah, then there's this guy named Lorien who sounds an awful lot like that Inquisitor guy we saw in season two. I'm a little confused, Gilfus. What's going on?
Well, you know, when you start noticing it, because I don't know, is this really my first watch... through or rewatch through of Babylon 5, maybe my third one, but anyway I haven't really been, now I'm sort of looking for things upon this rewatch, and so, like, mm-hmm. Wayne Alexander, of course, is who we're talking about.
Yes.
He shows up a lot. Like, he's almost the Jeffrey Combs of Babylon 5, because I was watching latter half of the season. I want to say it was the interrogation one, where he just plays, like, the random Drazi.
Oh, right. Yeah, he does.
Yes. He probably has, like, three lines in the whole thing. But anyway, so, like, Wayne Alexander, you know, he doesn't mind putting the makeup on, you know, and so I think he's a utility player Sometimes he's big as life, as he is with Lorian, and then with the interrogator. You know, some call him Jack. Just Jack. but yeah, I think he's sort of one of those people, like, if I was having, you know, you go to a con, a Babylon 5 con, there'd probably be a Wayne Alexander booth, and that'd be cool to talk to him.
Oh, yeah, totally. The thing is Wayne Alexander has such a distinct voice, and the way that, like, his diction is the same between the Inquisitor and Lorian. I didn't notice it quite so much with the Drazi. I don't know if is it the makeup, but between Lorian and the Inquisitor, it's kind of obvious if you're paying half attention. Now, in real time when the show was airing, I think there had been enough space in years to not quite hear it so loudly. But when you're trying to binge through it as fast as we are, where about every month we're doing these, it's kind of obvious. And that's not to his detriment. It's just, it sounds like Lorian is Jack and vice versa.
Now, with Babylon 5, for lack of a better word, there's a lot of mysticism. Well, not a lot, but there's some mysticism in Babylon 5, for lack of a better word. But with Lorian, so he's supposed to be the first one, I guess, you know, if we're to believe his story. Not that I'm all paranoid after being missing for several days for any reason. But
you all right, buddy?
Yeah. Well, no, I am going to resign from this podcast. I just don't like the direction you're going in, Char.
Really? Wow.
You think you're
have
better.
Have you been getting secret messages?
I did write a smiley face on my monitor before we started recording, if that was...
You said tried.
Yes.
Yeah, I take it you didn't completely get there?
No.
It wasn't a smiley face?
Well, it's hard to do it
this
on a
This is not good.
Yeah. But I think with Lorian, like, so do you buy... I guess this is my question. Do you buy, like, that he's the first dude? You know, the first. And in other words, and then, like, did he just come from nowhere? Like, I mean, I'm not trying to get too creationist here, but I'm just like, what's the story?
You can really get into this, right? Where if he is the first of all the first ones, does that make him God? Does that make him an omnipotent being? What exactly is Lorian? We don't know on purpose because of that whole, I think, the mysticism aspect of it. He has to be mysterious. And I think, yes, not explaining it is an easy way of making it easier on writing him. Because then you don't have to go into every little detail. But if you're going to bring somebody back from the dead,
right?
Because Sheridan fell a good 2 miles, he's very dead.
Of course, I think, and as we talk about the Wayne Alexander phenomenon, Lorian has a couple lines, and I don't know, maybe it's not the first episode, but maybe the second or third one, where he's like, you know, between yes or no or whatever. And it just sounds so like the interrogator. I'm like, at least change up his dialogue, you know.
Right? Well, even when he's asking the questions of who are you? Yeah. What do you want? I'm having the flashbacks to where they're in Grace Sector and Sheridan's in chains. And
why are you here?
Exactly. I don't know if they did that on purpose, but if they did, that's brilliant. That just occurred to me.
One thing, though, and this is going to sound sacrilege, Lorian... his dialogue did get annoying after a while. Like, he was almost too mystical talk. I'm like, just talk regular. Everything doesn't have to be. Like, I got Kosh if I want to get, you know, talk about, you know.
Right. Well, I guess Lorian, he's older and he's maybe more advanced than the Vorlons. He's got to outdo the Vorlons in that sense. And that's a difficult task. Mm. I don't know. The Lorian thing, I think you just have to go with it. Mm-hmm. But unless you're Garibaldi and you're not buying it and you're suspicious, which we'll have to get down to, because I think Garibaldi has good reasons for his distrust of what's going on. But we'll get there.
Yeah. So Sheridan's back. And that was, I guess we knew it, but you know, you never know how it's going to happen. And then I sort of like the journey of that, you know, I guess theoretically, I don't know how deep you want to get into it, but we basically see him in purgatory, for lack of a better word, for the first couple of episodes.
Yeah, more or less.
Yeah. And so he's sort of deciding where to go, or Lorian's helping to decide where to go. And that sort of, he has to relive the death again to make the fall again when he decides to live, I guess, because of Delenn.
Does he have anything worth living for?
That's right. Delenn.
That's right. But it works. He comes back to Babylon 5, rouses up the troops, gets them motivated to fight the Shadow War because they thought he was dead, but he's better now. And there's work to be done.
Well, I did like, you know, it's one of those things where you don't want to, like, or at least, I don't know, I feel weird pointing out, like, oh, it's the women. But when you were talking about that mission they did, it sort of just seemed obvious. It's pointedly the women of the cast are out there, which, I mean, it just happens to be these are the characters, I guess. But then Delenn, of course, is trying to rouse this fleet to go attack Zahadum, you know, before she knows that John is alive. And so I think it's very interesting to see all the great women characters sort of really shouldering everything of like, we're going to get this solved. We're going to do things. And so it's kind of a chance for them all to shine.
And it's not very often that you see them all together for one mission like that. In fact, this might be the only time, if I'm recalling correctly. So that's pretty cool. I really like that. It's nice to see them working together, and they're all kind of offering their own little strength to it all. And Ivanova, she is shouldering a huge amount of the burden of just running the station, trying to carry Sheridan's mission, coping with the grief, just trying to keep it together. I think this was really understated in the first part, like this early part of the fourth season. And she, I mean, despite drinking some vodka and being up all night, she's handling it like a pro. Let's be honest. But Sheridan does come back and she can relinquish some of that control back to him. However, we have this whole thing now with this other Kosh guy. Because if you recall, Kosh died last season. And there's this other Kosh. He seems a little shady. He has a bad attitude. He doesn't seem very nice. No. And ultimately, we got to get rid of him.
Yeah, and I think it's one thing I thought about with Evil Kosh. I know he has a sort of off-canon name, but I just can't remember what it is off the top of my head.
I just call him Kosh 2.
Yeah, because apparently in the comics there's actually a name, what his name is. But anyway, it doesn't matter. It does make you wonder what the Vorlons are like, because we've only met two. We've met Kosh and we've met Kosh. And so, like, is Kosh more like the Vorlons, or is Kosh more like the Vorlons? Or is it, you know, they're just a diverse species. We just happen to get, like, the semi-cool one and then the semi-jackass one. And then
they're all Kosh.
Yeah, well, because, you know, obviously, as season four, we were obviously the Vorlons show their uglier side. Or maybe that was their side all the time. But it does make you wonder about what are Vorlons actually like.
It's tough, because once we do start getting into resolving the Shadow War, the Vorlons are not the good guys we were initially believing them to be, say, in season three.
Mm-hmm.
They were more of the parental figures. Maybe they were there to help us. That ends up not being so true later on.
Right. And I guess we always knew that Kosh was in Sheridan. You know, Lorian has that line, do you know you have a Vorlon inside you?
Yeah.
And so, you know, Leeta is sort of on a mission from Kosh to see who has Kosh's Katra. That's not what they call it. I'm just mixing Star Trek stuff in there. And so, you know, trying to see what's going on. So is that just like something that happens when Vorlons die? Do they do Vulcan style, you know, or is it just, you know?
Remember.
Yeah.
I don't know. We don't have enough context to know for sure how that works.
They kill the other, well, they kill Kosh, the second Kosh too, so.
Yeah, and he's pretty dead and gone. I get the feeling that Vorlon deaths are not a very common thing based on how the Vorlons took the death of the original Kosh.
Mm-hmm.
That's just about it, is they don't do it very often. They must live a long time, and they don't particularly like it, I don't think.
Yeah, because I think once you have the Vorlons acting up, and then starting to attack, and then you sort of still have the Vorlon ambassador, it becomes very awkward. Then when Sheridan has the idea, and I don't know, what do you think of that? How to jump from Kosh is a problem, let's go kill him. You know, like, you know, there's not a medium step there.
Yeah, I mean, Sheridan comes back from the dead, and he is a very changed guy. I mean, I suppose dying would do that to you. You suddenly mean some serious business. He does seem to make that leap pretty quickly. But given the guy's character, I mean, you have to consider how condensed this season is. Had we maybe gotten a little bit of an opportunity to get to know Kosh 2 a little more, maybe seen him abuse Leeta a little more even, then we'd be like, yeah, kill him. Get rid of this bastard. But we kind of have to take what we get. And okay, I mean, I didn't like him. It was fine that he died. Good riddance. What did you think?
Well, it's sort of like there's a running storyline or a repeating storyline in the season of, hey, there's a bad guy, we should kill him. So you have you have the Vorlon ambassador, you have the Centauri Emperor. I don't think they're out to kill Clark, so I wouldn't include him per se. They just want to remove him. Regime change.
Yeah.
So there's some interesting things about that. But like you said, we get to see the Vorlons using their planet killers, the Shadows using their planet killers or cloud, or one of them has a cloud, one of them has a killer. So it's interesting where the Shadow War goes from just being, you know, the shadows attacking all the non-aligned worlds to the Vorlons and the shadows sort of like giants in a playground. And
right. They're just now attacking each other.
And then sort of attacking where the other people are. So like if the shadows have a base, you know, with the Drazi, or the Vorlons have a base, you know, and start sort of attacking the ones who can't defend themselves sort of as a proxy war against.
Right.
Maybe because they don't begin openly attacking each other. They sort of attack their allies first.
Yeah. And suddenly this is not at all about what it started out being, because we eventually learned that the Shadows and the Vorlons both had different ideas of how they wanted to guide the younger races to develop in the universe. And now it's just flat out, let's kill you. Let's kill it all. You know, if you're the enemy, you're going down.
Mm.
Now, before we delve totally into the Shadow War, I want to make one more kind of comment on Sheridan. And that is, we lost him to get him back, only to kind of lose him again, sort of. He only has 20 years. What did you think about this whole thing?
It was hard for me, knowing how the rest of this goes, to sort of put myself back of hearing
yeah,
this
indeed.
For the you know, hearing this for the first time. But I think it's interesting. Well, I think, you know, you have to pay a price, or at least Sheridan has to pay a price. He can't just be like, he got from back from the dead and everything's perfect. I think a price had to be paid for Zahadum.
I mean, that was revealed to us in War Without End. Delenn said the terrible, terrible price.
Yeah.
That he paid for going to Zahadum. We kind of knew it was coming, but I also think from a storytelling perspective, it's fair, because then you do take that mysticism down just a little bit of a notch. You inject a little bit of realism into it where he can bring him back only so much.
Right.
He's going to do what he needs to do, and then that's it. He's out.
Yeah, and he'll just stop.
That's right.
And I mean, because I think Babylon 5 does this good job of using hard time. Like, in other words, like, 1,000 years ago, there was a great war, and we go back 1,000 years when we have Babylon 4, or, you know, the Earth-Mimbari War was 10 years ago, or, you know, and that all these things happen in definite periods, and even in the future, stating these things, you know, whether we know that Londo, we saw last season, as you said, with the flash forward, we saw Londo and Jakar killing each other, Vir picking up the Emperor. Like, we know that's going to happen. But that doesn't spoil anything, in as much as it does, but because we don't know how it happens. We don't know. And so I think JMS, one of the geniuses about Babylon 5 is that just spoiling away and just showing the ending or showing the last page of the book, but you don't know what that means. You don't know how you got there, and you can play with that.
Yeah, no, JMS is really good at this. He does give us these tidbits, but the fun, the journey, and how it gets there is far more interesting than that piece of information itself, which not a lot of writers can do that well. He does, though. He does it masterfully in Babylon 5.
I mean, there's a reference later in the documentary at the end of, there's like a passing reference, like, oh, the incident with their son. And like, we don't know what that means. And so like, this is throwaway line of what's going to go with David Sheridan.
Right.
But anyway, but you know, same
and
thing
what's
here.
What's fun is he'll leave us those little breadcrumbs along the way. Like when we get into season 5, we learn at least a little hint of what that whole thing might be about, but we still don't know everything. Not in the least.
Right. And so just putting in because, not to jump ahead, but because how we know what the way it ends, you know, president of the Alliance, but we know, so Sheridan has 20 years, that's it, to do whatever he's going to do. And so I think that's an interesting thing of, you know, in season 5, obviously we're only going to see a year, but how that goes, and then the references we may see in the future, because we know there is an ending point to Sheridan. Of course, there's an ending point for everyone, but a definite ending
point
for Sheridan.
But he knows.
Yeah.
Barring illness or injury, 20 years is going to be the cutoff point. That's not something a lot of us have to deal with. The closest thing I can think of is, say, if you find out you have a terminal illness and say you know you have a year to live.
Yeah, and one thing, and I know you wanted to talk about this, I don't know if you want to talk about this now or later, but the fact that he knows early on in this season that he has 20 years left, do you think that affects Sheridan, how he acts? Because he's really living for today, that maybe he's riskier, maybe he's more quote-unquote dangerous, you know, whatever, because he knows time's limited. He can't just, oh, well, let's hope things get better, because he knows.
Yes. Oh, I think, going into the Earth conflict, that dramatically has changed Sheridan's perspective, knowing we do not have time to waste anymore, and no, we cannot count on the folks at Earth to take care of things with President Clark anymore. Things are just getting even more and more out of control. We've got to put our foot down. This needs to be put to an end, and it's time to take action. And Sheridan is not one to just sit around and twiddle his thumbs anyway. But yes, he does become more dangerous. He and Delenn have that conversation where you're holding back, she says to him, because you have changed, but you don't want us all to know just how much you have changed. But you have. You can't fool me. I see it. So she goes off and deals with some things back on Minbar so that he can be dangerous. And that is a part of what sets things motion, setting for up for that.
Yeah, I just want to throw that out there, though. I mean, just something to think about and we can move on as a thought experiment for both us and listeners. What if you had 20 years left? Because I think it's one of those things, like, it's not like, well, what if you had 1 day left or 1 week left? Well, then you just do crazy stuff. But no, what if you only had 20 years left? I mean, that's sort of a, it's not forever, but it's not tomorrow. Would that affect the way you change your life? I don't know, it's one of those sort of spirit or whatever questions you get. But I mean, like, 20 years, I mean, that's really would make you think. Because you're not going to, like, go out and spend all your money and go on vacations. Because that's, like, a week later, you know. But if you only knew right now, you only had 20 years left, how would that affect the decisions in your life?
Oh, I think it would dramatically change how you spent your days, what you wanted to get out of those 20 years, and how you would go about that. You would probably go in with a lot more organization so that you can accomplish those things with what time you do have, because you know it's finite. You either do or you don't.
There is no try.
That's right. So the Shadow War.
Man, I mean, can we just talk about the fact that, you know, I'm sitting here and watching season four, and I know this isn't my first rodeo. I know the Shadow War is going to end. I know the Earth War is going to end. We all kind of jam-packed it. So I'm watching season four, you know, with my wife watching it as always with me. But anyway, so I'm like, Shadow War, Shadow War, and I'm like, episode 6 and we're done? I'm like, we're not even like, I think I'm on my second disc in the collection here.
It is kind of oddly timed because most of the time when you have a war on TV, they make it at the very least like a mid-season explosive kind of mid-season finale. Mm-hmm. Or it is the big time end of season finale. But no, this is somewhere just right in the middle. And of course, this is brought about because of the danger of cancellation with season four. JMS had to massively bump things up in case season four was the very last for Babylon 5. They knew that early on going in the season that there was a very good chance that this was going to be it. And so what we see of season four is so jam-packed for that reason. It moves so fast because his original plan was to spread things out a little bit into season five. It's unfortunate that that didn't happen, but he kind of did what he had to do here. And so if it's awkward, that is why.
Right. So, I mean, you know, it's one of those things, though, as you go through season four, you're kind of like, well, it's not like they didn't have stuff to do. You know, there's no season four episodes where we're twiddling our thumbs because we got all this free time because we ended the Shadow War early. So you can't really, I suppose you could complain, but you can't really complain. So you're like, I mean, because I guess that's sort of the point of the end of the Shadow War, that it's, you know, kind of like Marcus, like, did we win?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely this sort of anticlimactic feel about the end of the Shadow War. I mean, we were getting some pew 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 for a little bit, but the very end of it, the resolution of it, it's all talking.
Yes.
And it's basically telling the Shadows and the Vorlons both where to stick it and to go away.
This is, of course, you know, when it comes to metaphors, especially talking to you, Char, only Star Trek metaphors come to mind. But I'm almost thinking of like the Borg and Voyager, where they sort of get, for lack of a better word, defanged. But like, does this sort of defang the Shadows and the Vorlons? Because they almost seem like sort of like whimpering children in that last scene of like, can you go with us? Are we going to be all alone in the whim?
You know, I actually really love that because, yes, it does kind of neuter them, but it shows that they aren't nearly as big and bad as we thought they were. They're scared little children just like all of us.
Right, and they're almost like, when you really get, because we got a bit of it in season three when Sheridan met his quote-unquote wife and the other main dude talking about, you know, what this is all about, what this whole war is really about with the Shadows, but we even get it more now. Yeah, Justin, and we even get it now. Lorian talks about it a little bit too, but everything, and it's like these just two teenagers who both think they're right, and I mean, you could say it's just old men too, which is Sometimes it'd be
a
similar mentality. Yeah. Old fogies on the porch talking about better days, or we know how to do it. But, you know, and so who's right, who's wrong? You know, this is the only way to do it is chaos, and the only other way is to be an overbearing parent and helicopter parent. And, you know, it's like, well, who cares? You know, let's let them figure it out themselves. Or your children are like 40 years old. I don't think you really need to worry about how they need to be parented as much as, you know, let's let them do it for themselves. And so
right.
I think, because, I mean, even as evil, quote unquote, that the Vorlons and Shadows are, at heart, they just want to make the other races better. I mean, they have an ideological point, but they theoretically, underneath that ideological point, is that they want to make people better. And so what does that actually mean?
Supposedly.
Yeah.
But something got really lost along the way, and they were doing it wrong.
Mm-hmm. And so it's time for let the kids grow up, as Sheridan says.
That's right. That's right. This is ours now.
Now get the hell out of our galaxy.
Both of you. Now, meanwhile, in the midst of the conclusion of the Shadow War, we have some action going on Centauri Prime, and it is just a little bit crazy.
I really enjoy the storyline, and I feel like I struggle this whole series with Londo. Not because of anything about his character, but my struggle is Londo my favorite character? And I would say, well, no. I mean, there's you know, there's Sheridan, but I'm like, maybe he is, because I just feel like he's so intriguing. Like, it is almost Londo, and I've said this before in other episodes, but Londo's storyline is Babylon 5. And so I think this is not necessarily the apex, per se, but with him and Veer and Emperor Cartaja, it's so fascinating. I love it. About, you know, this crazy leader, you know, doing all of these crazy things. Londo trying to keep things in line, because he's arguably responsible for this crazy person taking charge. I mean, Lord Reef.
Somebody even said as much.
Yeah.
It might have been Morden telling him, look, you got this party started. Now you... You can't be complaining about what you did.
Yeah, and I think it was maybe one of the Centauri noblemen that was in his conspiracy. They're like, you know, it's your fault. And he's like, hey, it's Rifa, and maybe it is my part. And if it is my fault, I'll have to answer that at another time. But yeah, and it gets crazier, the torture of Jakar.
The scream, the eye. I mean, serious drama watching all of that play out. I mean, my heart just sinks watching Jakar come out into the Emperor, just knowing this stupid flamboyant guy, Cartaja, who doesn't give a rat's you-know-what about him, is going to treat him worse than he would treat an animal. And that's, I mean, and that's also an insult to animals. I love animals, and I treat them better than humans. But it's horrible. Absolutely horrible. And watching Londo kind of suffer through that, too, to see this horror, well, it's good for Londo, I think.
Yeah, because you sort of see the face... Sounds flippant to say the face of crazy, but he's eccentric, as all emperors are, I suppose. And that's kind of where Londo comes from. Okay, he's whatever. He's a kid. I'll handle him with kid gloves. But when it starts to be like, no, I'm going to become a god. I'm going to become a god now. And let me take you to my room with all the heads of the people I've killed, because I'm going to become a god and the shadows can burn this world. And Londo's eyes are just getting bigger and bigger and bigger, you know, of like...
Yeah, he's not like, oh, fun in a crazy drunken way. This is like, oh, this dude is really crazy and he's going to kill us all.
Mm-hmm. And even though I knew it was going to happen, I think, you know, Londo has this grand... Again, sort of jumps the same thing, like, we have to kill Cartaja. That's sort of, you know, there's no medium. You know, there's not like... Maybe we can do some political machinations, overthrow. It's like, no, we got to kill him. And so...
Yeah. I think Cartaja crosses that line very well on his own. I mean, the conclusion is not hard to come to whatsoever.
Right. But to have the... And I feel like this is a repeating theme, but to have the innocent hand of Veer be the one who strikes down Cartaja, I think is just one of the most... Well, it's not the most powerful moment in Babylon 5, but it's at least in the top 25 of at least a character moment. I mean, for Veer's character moment is killing Cartaja.
Yes.
I don't know, you know, maybe top three at least for him.
Oh, yeah. I think for Veer, this is a very defining moment, and I love that moment. I love that it's Veer, the aftermath of that, where he just gets so drunk and he's... I'm not sure if he's trying to numb out his emotions, but he's feeling them anyway. The dude is a wreck. It just shows so much about how much of a conscience Veer has, even though he did a good thing, and he knows he did,
right.
He still feels terrible about killing another living being.
Right.
If Londo had done it, he was just, well, I did what I had to do, but Veer breaks down, and that's a lot more fun to watch.
Yeah, because I think it's almost sort of a very cool comparison between the two of them, because Londo is literally fumbling with trying to kill Kartasha. Veer just does it.
He's in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, and I think that sometimes, if you want to look at it, Veer does what he does. Like, as much as Londo is a strong believer in traditions and everything, Londo fumbles throughout his whole story about how he wants to get things done, what he wants. Veer does what he wants. I mean, he's not that decisive, maybe, in his head. But if you look at it, what Veer wants, Veer tends to get. So, you know, I think he may make a good emperor one day.
maybe. No, I think you're very right, though. You make a great point about Londo. He has, I think, good intentions. But when it comes to executing them, he does screw up. I mean, that pretty much is his story throughout Babylon 5. And I think that is sort of what damns him through his whole life up until his death. Whereas Veer, dare I say it, is a little smarter about the whole thing. Veer can, I think, look at the big picture a little more, see how the consequences of his actions might play out, and choose accordingly.
Mm-hmm.
Londo, not quite so much. He just knows he wants point B, doesn't really think about how it's going to happen. But then he gets there and he realizes, oh, that was a little bit of a train wreck. Shoot. Now I got to clean it up.
So we get to visit Narn. I mean, we've done a little bit, but we really get to visit Narn with the whole, you know, it's almost as if they took the same set of Centauri Prime and just said it was a Narn. I mean, I don't know. That's me being cynical.
I mean, this was a low budget show, so it's possible.
I like how they're like on Narn, like, wow, this really looks like it. I'm like, because it's the same. They didn't touch
it. It's the occupation, man. Give them some slack.
They changed the lighting. But anyway, no, I'm kidding. But anyway, so free Narn. This whole thing of Jakar being captured and the whole torture we see and everything else, but Londo sort of strings him along. I mean, not in a bad, well, in a bad way, I suppose, but not being dishonest.
Yes. Okay,
I know I'm asking a lot, but here's the price. You help me, you get your dumb planet, I get my dumb planet back as well.
Right. Jakar does pay a terrible price, but it frees his people from a Centauri at last. Jakar, he has, I think, despite the suffering, he has no problem doing that. He's going to do whatever that takes.
Right.
And, I mean, we see that in action. That happens. And I love his line where he says, after he has his eye plucked out, I can see things that I couldn't see before. It's the growth, the continued growth, and the wisdom of Jakar.
Yeah, because following his imprisonment in season 3,
yeah.
I think, you know, we see the more reflective Jakar after he realizes the price he's paid for all of his hate of the Centauri, and he sort of sees the reflection of what that's all meant, and then sees the role of Narn, the role of sacrifice. But maybe he just knows it, you know, as a metaphor, an analogy. I mean, he believes in it. But then when it comes to his time on Centauri, he literally has to sacrifice an eye. He has to sacrifice his dignity. He has to...
Yeah, all
and
of
so
it.
So it's interesting, yeah, that he could have sort of changed his ideology at that point. Like, I don't know about all this. On second thought. But of course, he kind of stays with that. And
yeah, I mean, it really shows what Jakar is truly made of. He's put to his ultimate test. Can he stand by the things that he's been saying? The answer is absolutely, and then some.
Yeah. What have you endured?
Yeah, so then, I mean, we get to kind of see how that plays out among his people next season.
Mm-hmm. But and we sort of get the, not that we haven't always had it, but we sort of get the Londo-Jakar relationship at the tail end. So, you know, they go through this whole big thing. They eventually meet back at the station, and, you know, sort of awkward, obviously. But then they start having to do all these things together. Because, you know, if the Narn and Centauri can agree on X, then, hey, that's a big thing. And they have to do that a couple times a season. Well, they don't have to, but they choose to do that a couple times a season, helping with Sheridan and the like.
Right.
But at the end, you sort of have them doing the, they start doing their old married couple thing.
I suppose going through this amount of hell is either going to make or break them. And they develop this weird, I don't want to say close relationship, but they do have
banter,
a bonding. Yeah, they do work together and they are bantering back and forth. And it's kind of nice. So let's switch gears a little bit and jump over to Minbar.
Every planet is not doing well this year.
Yeah, you know, everybody's having a really difficult time dealing with things, it seems.
Whether it's Occupied Narn, Centauri with the Crazy Emperor, Minbar, which we always think of this sort of planet of crystals and semi-enlightenment or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Waterfalls.
But they're having troubles. Yeah, but they're having some troubles, apparently. Well, Delenn's fault, admittedly,
when
she broke the Grey Council.
Yeah, she's got to deal with some things this season. She's spending a lot of time on Minbar. The first thing is she has to, I guess, justify, is that the right word? Her relationship with Sheridan, with her clan, because they do not approve. He's a human. How dare she bring in pure blood into the Minbari? We get to find out.
Valen.
Exactly. We find out that the children of Valen, being part human and part Minbari, that's not a publicly known fact among the Minbari people. It's something that's pretty guarded pretty closely. So that's kind of interesting. And the whole thing with Dukat, the dreaming to the days of starting the Earth-Minbari War, we learn that Delenn essentially started that war in the wake of her grief.
Mm-hmm.
So nobody's perfect. Everybody makes a mistake in Babylon 5. I think that might be the biggest scar Delenn has in her life.
Right. I mean, and that sort of came out, the argument has sometimes been the reason that she's doing all this is to make up for that war, to make up for the, you know, the death of
her mentor, Dukat.
Dukat. I was still trying to, yeah. I was like, I knew it's a Star Trek.
Yeah.
But yeah, and I think, to me, I mean, not to spoil anything, but in the movie, in the beginning, we'll see a lot of this again. But it's kind of weird to see these scenes in the season and be like, that's literally what we see in the movie. I mean, because it's sort of, to me, it's almost epic. Because in my mind, those are movie scenes, even though it's just a TV movie. But to see them in an episode of, in the beginning, of going back to the beginnings of the death of Dukat. And, you know, Delenn has to put on the old makeup again.
Yeah, isn't that kind of a trip to see that version of Delenn when we've gotten so used to the half-human hybrid now?
Yeah, and I think it's interesting to think of, well, I don't want to say the myth of Valen, because it's true. But anyway, the story of Valen, the legend of Valen, whatever you call that, you know, how did he die, you know, whatever, you know, kind of can have some that exist on Earth of various beliefs. But like, Valen had children. Oh, wait, that's crazy. What does that mean? But then, of course, the whole thing, as JMS always does with this series, it all explains so much, because why did the crystal luminary glow with Delenn? Why did it glow with Sinclair?
Yeah, you know, all these little things, these puzzle pieces suddenly fit.
And of course, it's all sort of like a loop, because theoretically, I think he got that from Epsilon of the Great Machine. and so, you know, it's all, you know, comes together.
Yeah, it is fun, though. I mean, we're in season 4 and we're learning all of this new stuff, partially based in things that we know, combining it with new information, and then, oh, I mean, it's still happening after all this time.
So Minbar has gone to chaos because they don't have any leaders, I suppose, with the Grey Council gone. And so the clans are fighting. Mm-hmm. Or, well, not the clans. The
castes.
Castes, thank you. They're different, yeah. But so it's basically the religious versus warrior, which I like. I wonder who's going to win between the religious and the warrior caste. Yeah, I don't know. But anyway, so surprise, the warrior end up winning. But it was funny watching the episodes and the stories that went along, because with Nerun, he agrees to meet Delenn, and it's always been a weird relationship with them.
Yes.
And you're like, okay, they seem to be getting along. And then he escapes. And you're like, oh, he betrayed her. I remember watching it with my wife, and we both thought, oh, man, that he seemed like a nice guy.
Yeah.
Oh, well, he screwed us all. Because then
what a jerk.
He's talking with his general, or the head of the warrior caste. And you're like, oh, man. And then it turns out that he's a double bluff. He was working with Delenn the whole time. It's all a ruse.
Right. So he ends up sacrificing himself for Delenn, who then reforms the Grey Council in equal parts between religious, warrior, and worker, and the Nine is back in balance.
No. I have to correct.
What did I miss?
It is not equal at all. She does equal amounts of warrior and religious.
Oh.
But the majority is worker
yes,
caste.
Yes, you're right. I screwed that up. Thank you for the correction. Yes, yes. It's a very good thing, actually. I think it's about time the worker caste gets a little bit more acknowledgement in the leadership.
Because I almost wonder, I think one can make the mistake of watching Babylon 5 and thinking it's only warriors and religious.
Yes.
And it's like, worker caste?
Like, we hear that they're supposed to be a part of this whole thing, but we see dealings with the religious caste and the warrior caste. So where are the workers? I guess they're busy building White Stars for a good portion of the show. But it's about time we really see some representation. Representation matters. And let's face it, I imagine there's a nice majority of Minbari who are worker caste. They deserve to get their due.
Rise of the worker.
Yeah.
Solidarity.
Solidarity. Love it. All right. Well, I think we've put this off long enough. We need to talk about Mr. Garibaldi. We brought it up earlier, but we need to go into some detail now.
Do you remember watching this for the first time, what you thought? Because the plus that I got was I watched it with my wife, who's watching it for the first time. And when she first, I don't know, I'd have to ask her, of course. But, you know, when, you know, he, of course, resigned and all that and went to private practice, and maybe that makes sense. But then when he started to talk against Sheridan, they said to me, oh, they're probably secretly working together, Sheridan and Garibaldi. Like, it's a ruse so that Garibaldi can find out what's going on and da-da-da.
That's so cute.
And then, and as we go further and further along, you know, as we go deeper along, and it's like Garibaldi's going to give Sheridan up, and she's like, oh my God, he's not really going to, is he? And of course he does.
Yeah.
And then, you know, she's like, what the heck's going on? And then when we find out the whole reason of what happened to Garibaldi the whole season, then it's kind of like, ah, we hate Chuck.
Indeed. So going way back to when I very first watched this whole thing, I too thought that maybe Sheridan and Garibaldi were in a little bit of cahoots together to, I don't know, I wasn't entirely sure, I don't think, of what exactly was going on. I just figured, oh, we're going to eventually find out. But I did think that they were working together because I didn't want to think of Garibaldi as a bad guy. I hated that. But he was coming off a little abrasive, a little negative. And I just thought, what is this all this for? And so then when you get that big reveal in the transport train with Bester, just kill Bester, kill Bester, you bastard.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought, now it all makes so much sense. Because, like, you know, things are not quite right. He gets that transmission that's just, okay, something's definitely going on with that for sure. But then there is also a part of Garibaldi that just is naturally suspicious. It's just who he is. And that's what makes him so good as a security officer. You think, well, not everybody is in real life, if this were real life, not everybody is going to be on board with Sheridan, right? I mean, there's got to be some dissenters. Garibaldi, if anybody, being the suspicious person that he is, if he has any distrust, it's going to be him going against Sheridan. So,
yeah, and kind of as a musical fan, though this is obviously not necessarily a unique story, but watching when Garibaldi was still in Babylon 5, talking about how Sheridan become different, this religious figure, all I could hear was Judas singing in Jesus Christ Superstar. You know, all the things, you know, get out of hand. There was no talk of God before. You know, you were just a man.
Yeah,
you know.
Well, and in Sheridan's defense, he's not the one who did that. It's the people around him who started worshiping him. Like that lady who gets kind of trampled in the crowd and he brings her up. And all of a sudden, oh, you're Sheridan. You came back from the dead. Oh,
yeah.
It's people like that who are putting him up on that pedestal. It's not Sheridan himself, despite the fact that, yes, his mindset has changed. I think the combination of those two things and Garibaldi watching it from the outside says, okay, this is not the Sheridan that I once knew. I don't think I like this.
Because you sort of get the, as Judas and Jesus Christ Superstar does, that the argument that he makes to himself, and maybe even though Garibaldi's under the influence, but that Garibaldi, in his twisted way, is making to himself, and I don't know if he fully believes it, even when he says it, but at least he says it, like, and others say it to him, you know, Sheridan might thank you for helping him that things have gotten out of hand and that you really, you know, you'd be doing him a favor. He wants you to betray him,
right.
You know, and sort of that sort of what it gets into. And so,
yeah,
you know, and Garibaldi's like, I don't really don't think he's going to thank me for this, but he still goes for it. And, you know, using tracking down his father, Sheridan's father. And then of course the scene
oh.
of when Garibaldi betrays.
Oh man. Watching this in the rewatch for the first time, I thought, oh, blank. This moment. And then I had a really funny afterthought of that bar music, though. I really dig it. I ended up finding it on YouTube, a full version. I listen to mm-hmm. it all the time now in my work playlist. I love it that much. And I'll be sure to put the link in the show notes in case anybody else is interested. But I'm so happy to know that grunge music lived on in the Babylon 5 universe, being a child of the 90s.
Well, I mean, Zima did, so
right?
why not?
If Zima can live on, so can grunge. So yeah, that's a tough scene to watch, just watching Sheridan get the bejesus beaten it to death out of him, and knowing that Garibaldi's doing this for what, some silver as payment.
Yeah.
And you're just like, okay, mm-hmm. Garibaldi, what the hell? Because you don't want to believe that he really is a bad guy, but he's crossed a line now.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, when that happens, like, there's no doubt of whether he gave him up and Sheridan's gone and all that.
Yeah, now he's being interrogated and all of that. But one more thing I want to bring up with Garibaldi is the whole dealings with William Edgars, as well as...
And Lise and Mars.
Yeah, and the telepaths. Oh, God, we can't believe we're back on Mars. I love that monologue because he says that about 5 times. Mars.
Yeah.
I can't believe I'm back on Mars. It almost killed me. Mm-hmm. And I thought I'd never be back here. I can't believe I'm back on Mars.
And then she walked in.
Yeah, and then there's Lise, and we learn about this telepath virus, and William Edgars, who has more money in the world than he could ever possibly need, using Garibaldi to basically, you know, do some work and collect some information, and ultimately lead Sheridan to capture. And by the way, is he still in love with Lise? Yes? No? Circle on the form, if you would, please. I need to know. What did you think of William Edgars?
I thought, well, this is what I was thinking. Like, he's turns cartoonishly evil to me. I mean, he doesn't act. Like, it's not he's a very good actor. But the plot, anyway, is very cartoon evil. Like, oh, telepaths, hey, here's a secret illness, and then we have the cure, and, you know, they must pay us $1 million. You know, and it's just sort of, okay. But then I think about it. I feel like I'm going there. But, like, okay, so telepaths. If you think about it, and especially our experiences as in Babylon 5 watching, we don't get a lot of love about telepaths. I mean, yeah, we see some of the good ones, Talia and
Lita.
Jason Ironheart. As a whole, yeah, Lita, but, you know, Psycor, we're not fans of. And so we would think, look, we don't want to kill them all. But, you know, it's at one point, I don't think it's a huge logic leap of where Edgars is coming from, a paranoia. Because we don't live with telepaths
or
in the real
world.
Or do we? But that fear, yeah, but the fear of telepaths, I mean, if you really try to make it out that way, and that things are brewing up, that they had a part with Clark... Because telepath can sometimes just mean Psycor. So just say Psycor instead of telepath. So with the Psycor, I mean, I could see that that's a plot where obviously no one, well, I hope no one ever wants to kill anyone or genocide, but like there's some building blocks of like, that could happen and that might not be an unpopular thing.
I do think that there is some truth into what William Edgars is saying because other people have also said previously that telepaths are, we kind of created our own monster. Sheridan said that 2 seasons ago. And I think
right.
Lita says in this season, someday there's going to be a war between telepaths and normals. You kind of see the writing on the wall, like what is going to happen here? And so Edgars, in his defense, he's just preparing for it. You know, he's doing what he can to help, I guess, preserve normals. But I do love what you said earlier. He is kind of like the Wile E. Coyote of Babylon 5. He is kind of a two-dimensional character. It doesn't seem to be all he cares about. But as a kind of minor character in this bigger epic story with so many other things and other people going on, I'm kind of willing to let it pass because, to be honest, I don't like him that much. I would much rather see Garibaldi develop his relationship with Lise again. And that I find much more interesting.
But then this is what I would throw out. Lise fell in love and married him.
Yeah.
Now, of course, we're seeing this quote-unquote hidden side. But, like, what kind of a person's Lisa is what I'm asking, you know? Because she married Fritz.
Franz.
I believe that was his name. And he... Franz. What kind of a name is Franz?
I know, right?
But apparently, so they had a child, if I'm correct, and he got custody of the child?
Something like that. It's not explained very well.
Yeah, it was very rushed to me. And so she sort of, I don't know, ended up meeting Edgar's. But anyway... So, you know, I always wonder, like, Garibaldi, is Lisa really the right girl for you? But anyway.
I mean, it is the love of his life. They keep kind of gravitating back toward each other. Lisa's a character, I remember really not liking her much either. So I thought, oh, she kind of deserved to be with this Edgar's guy. And what exactly does Garibaldi want with her? But sometimes the heart wants what the heart wants, right? You're just drawn to certain people, even if they're not good for you. And so in a way, at least at this juncture, that's how I felt about Lise, because I don't have her completely figured out. I don't know what her real motivations are. I don't know what it is she really wants. I feel like the only thing that we've really absorbed from her is that she's an opportunist. The right guy comes along, she'll marry him.
You're right. Yeah, she's, I mean, not to, like, because, yeah, there's a bunch of terrible man characters as well, but like as a female character, you're like, you're not doing the greatest. I mean, we got Dylan and Ivana, and we got Lisa, who
we've got plenty of better ladies, hate to say, in the cast. So while we're talking Mars, why don't we talk about the adventure that Stephen and Marcus had?
I am the very model of a modern major general.
thank you. This had to make that podcast. That is one of my favorite outtakes ever, and I memorized Modern Major General as a result of that episode.
Yes.
Cut. What? Beep, beep. So one of the small tidbits that I found really interesting in this whole thing is we learned that not everybody knew about the Shadow War back on Earth. I mean, they're so occupied with their own problems in their corner. They had no idea this whole other thing was going on. And I think Marcus says, like, that figures. When I'm a hero, nobody knows about it.
I think that's hilarious. It's kind of like almost being in a fandom of like, oh, this big thing just happened. Like, people are like, what? I've never heard of that show. You're like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
But like, yeah, just like.
It.
But yeah, I did think that was kind of. And it did give a proper appearance of what is going on Earth. Or, you know, even though it's Mars, but in the Earth Alliance.
Yeah, I mean, it does give perspective, right? It shows that things really are kind of under wraps. They are somewhat isolated. They get just about whatever ISN gives them, and that's not going to be much.
That's not good.
No, that's state news and horrible newscasting,
right?
If I do say so.
But yeah, so the character of number one, who we met when Franklin met, hey-ho. Previously, she doesn't get a lot to do necessarily, but she's an interesting character. An actress who's popped up in a lot of stuff. I remember when she was in an episode of Quantum Leap, a very subtle character. And I think one you could definitely play with, you know, in extended universe or in novels or whatever. But yeah, I thought it was definitely cool. Cause I mean, she certainly is not one note. Cause the one episode where you have the sort of radical leader blowing up the hotel or whatever, and she sort of like gives him the third degree about like, no, you're messing things up. And so
I mean, number one serves kind of like a really nice voice for the Mars Resistance. She's no nonsense. She puts people in their place. You can tell that she's got a grasp of the situation. I mean, she is the brains, and she is believable. She's exactly what you need to head up something like this. And she's one of those characters where, if you wanted to, you could expand upon her potential later in the future. Maybe we'll see her again. I don't know.
Well, Mars, like I said, Mars is just like the second setting for Babylon 5. But speaking of resistance, we have number one,
yes.
But we also have the voice of the resistance, who's another fine woman.
Yes, Susan Ivanova launches a new career, basically as a newscaster. I guess she's sort of like the Rachel Maddow, if you will, of Babylon 5, only I think she's got better hair. Hate to say it. Sorry, Rachel. But yeah, she kind of heads this thing up. Sheridan has this fantastic idea, wakes her up in the middle of the night in her nightie and doesn't even compliment her on her nightwear, which is completely rude. But then says, "You are so great with keeping everybody updated with the Shadow War. Why don't you do it again? Because people are getting fed this crap on ISN. And of course, this does come after they do that news piece on Babylon 5, which shows how they skew the news.
Right. Selectively edit.
Which is an interesting perspective on things. Where you say one thing and it comes across as another. Check your news sources, kids. And get full context. But anyway, yeah, Susan does these newscasts. And
we just want to let people know.
If she wanted to ever... What?
We just want to let people know that absolutely nothing happened today in quadrant 40 by 37. Just people had asked.
Of course it did.
I just want to let them know in the podcast. Definitely pay no attention to that area.
Yeah, nothing happened. I mean, maybe some rocks blew up, but that was it.
Yep.
Yes, yes. I feel that if Susan ever wanted to leave her career in Earth Force, she had a future as an ISN newscaster.
Ah, I agree.
Yeah. So... that was kind of a cool development for Ivanova, especially after all the hell that she went through earlier in the season. These aren't necessarily happier times, but she's maybe given, I don't know, happier things to do-ish?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, it's her operation. She's heading it up, and it just shows a new facet of her.
Yeah, because she's basically holding down the station at the beginning of the season. And then mm-hmm. she does other things, but not necessarily a lot until Voice of the Resistance, sort of in the middle of the season. And then at the end, when Sheridan's taken, she takes command of the fleet and sort of carries out the rest of the mission.
Yes, and she says a very important thing. The person is expendable, the mission is not.
Yeah.
And that is Sheridan's words to her. She's going to follow through with it, and she's one heck of a battle commander, as we learn.
Yeah, I think, yeah, when she makes that sort of... decision to take on the what are they called? The heavy cruisers? That's not what they're called. But anyway.
You're talking about the shadow ones with the destroyers.
Yes.
Speaking of which, the look of those things. Wow.
Yeah.
First time I saw that, I thought, okay, that's pretty badass. No, those are the bad guys. We got to shoot them. But they were pretty cool. And then, of course, this leads into... one of the most heartbreaking, well, couple of moments. First off, Ivanova gets fatally injured.
Right.
In the very end of the attack. Like, they clear the way all the way to Mars, but there's this piece of debris that just slams right into the bridge of her white star, breaking every bone in her body. Let's say, I don't know, they don't describe the injury, but it's not good.
Right.
It's not good at all. And that leads to what Marcus does.
And I think it's interesting where, you know, you have her sort of on her deathbed and Delenn and John are there and say goodbye and Marcus never leaves her side. And then I think he ends up leaving her side to, you know, to fight. And then...
well, at Delenn's insistence, she says, "We need you." And so he's basically, it looks like he's going to command the battle.
And Lanier, loose lips Lanier, lets lets it slip that there might be some technology back on Babylon 5 that would help. And so.
No. Mark, no, yeah. There's not. Mm-mm. You didn't hear anything.
Yeah. I double take back.
The way Bill Mumy delivers that line, it's just like, "Oh, Lanier. No."
But I think that was such a, like, and I don't know, you know, because JMS, of course. And I wasn't as good of a Lurker's Guide reader this season, but this is something that's very established in the first season. Second season? Anyway, in early Babylon
mm-hmm.
5.
It's the very end of the first season.
Yeah, speaking of Lost in Space alumni. But anyway, and so was it ever his intention to use it again to bring someone back this way? And I don't know what the answer is, because I thought I read somewhere, and I don't know, this may be wrong. I thought I saw that JMS said if he knew there'd be a season 5, he might not have killed Marcus. But yes, you have Marcus sacrificing himself for Susan.
Yeah, I do believe I read that as well, where if he'd gone with his original plan, I think Ivanova would have died rather than Marcus.
Hmm.
Because you're dealing now with the Deus Ex Machina, the healing device. Mm-hmm. And it's basically where you can't have both characters live. One of them does have to die if you're going to go through with this. So it's a matter of, well, which one is it? And then, of course, we eventually do have the departure of Claudia Christian, which I don't think was foreseen at this time at all.
Yeah, so it's like one of those things, if he had known. That, yeah, I have an actress who's
leaving.
Had JMS
known that, he probably would have just continued letting, like, that could have been Ivanova's exit. But hindsight. Yeah. And instead, we lose Jason Carter as Marcus. But Marcus's character was looking for this reason his whole time that we knew him over two seasons. I mean, he was always the one first to step up as the sacrificial victim and say, oh, I'll do it.
Right.
You know, when it came to putting people in danger. Garibaldi says a line in the very first season of, you know, there's people who are finding a reason worth dying for, and there's people who are finding a reason worth living for. Well, I don't think Marcus ever really got over the death of his brother, his family, and all that, and he was looking for a way to burn out and go out with the cause. So what better way for him to go out if he was going to do it? You can't top this, and he knew it.
Here's a question, and I know this is being sort of anti-romantic, but I'm trying to make it a little bit realistic. So, you know, Marcus has this great love for Susan and does this bold sacrifice. From Susan's side.
Yeah.
And I think you asked me this question last episode. How does she feel about Marcus, and would you feel if someone did this great sacrifice that maybe you're not even, that you're not, well, I mean, she was, you know, obviously respected him as a friend, but what if you're not into, like, how does that make you feel?
Well,
her guilt already, but, like, you know, she has to struggle with, did she love, I think she says it, but, like, is she just saying that upon reflection, or, like, how would it feel for someone who you're not that maybe into, other than a friend, but just this huge sacrifice and kills himself for you, and you're kind of like, don't, why did you do that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think we saw the very first part of that aftermath in Rising Star, where she has that nice speech with Franklin, and she's trying to sort out her feelings of, I knew that he loved me, why did he have to do this? I never would have asked him to. Because if she would have had any choice in the matter, absolutely not. He would not have done this. She would have found a way to stop him. But it was far too late. And I think, I don't know, are you getting to the point of where, like, she says, I knew that he loved me, I knew it, and I just didn't want to admit it? Implying that maybe she had a little thing for him, too?
Yeah, because it's, in some way, again, I'm only kind of being devil's advocate, but is it creepy, in other words? You know, I'm saying that Marcus is sort of throwing himself into someone who's not interested. I mean, obviously, if he loves her and sacrifices his life, he doesn't see that as anything bad. And even if he says to himself, well, I know she doesn't feel that way, but that doesn't matter because I do. But I mean, I just feel like that is a lot of load to put on Susan, this guilt of, like, I mean, I couldn't even love him, this guy who did this so much. I mean, maybe that'd be something, you know, but I can't, and I didn't, and, you know. And then
the only
thing
I can think of is Marcus did not think about how this would affect Ivanova. He's thinking,
right,
I love her, I must save her. That is all that's on his mind.
Right.
So, I mean, they did spend a lot of time together this season. I don't think there might have ever really been a romantic relationship, but I do think in her heart, Ivanova, I don't know, I think maybe she respected and maybe admired Marcus a little bit, just enjoyed his company a little more, just enjoyed him for who he was. Was she looking for romance? Absolutely not. She's still pushing that away, just not into that. But now that he's gone and he's put this massive load of guilt on her, she's wondering, should I have boffed him at least once? Because the poor guy died a virgin. She's feeling really bad about that.
Yes. Yeah.
And, you know, she thought, maybe I wish now, knowing what I know now, I would have tried one more time. You know, she's in the regret stage at this point now. She's thinking all that could have been.
Yeah.
Like, maybe I should have. Maybe I should have just at least tried one more time. I could have done for him. Now I can't. And so that's expounding upon her grief. So in a way, is it any wonder that she left Babylon 5? Because everywhere she's going to look around that station, it's going to be a memory of being with him or on a white star. She had to get out of there.
It was one of those things, like, even though I knew it's coming, because this would have been the, was it the last episode or
next
the next
to last
episode? But anyway,
ish.
Yeah, it just seems one of those, like, And Susan got promoted to captain, and then she's on a ship and she's gone for a year. Like, what?
What?
What happened?
You know, one of the funny things is that Susan Ivanova only gets promoted when there's change of CEO on Babylon 5. Because she got promoted to commander when Sheridan came aboard.
Yep.
And now that Sheridan is resigning from the Earth Alliance and a new commander is going to come into Babylon 5, she gets promoted to captain.
Yeah. But not of Babylon 5. She gets her own ship.
Right.
And they said, I don't remember. Do you remember the name of the ship? I don't even remember. I feel like they said it, but I don't remember the ship.
Oh, nope. I don't remember right now. Sorry.
But it was sort of like, it has like a year-long mission to deep space or something. So it's like, we're not going to see her again.
Right. So, I mean, essentially, I think she's running away.
Yeah.
And she's trying to figure out her feelings. And where better, but then the middle of nowhere.
Yes. So, you know, there's crazier reasons to do deep space.
It stinks, but it is a little understandable. I mean, this is an awful burden to carry. And I still have, and I think I've mentioned this before, but I still want to write out the fanfic idea of Ivanova processing her grief as the years go by, because we do see in the very last episode Ivanova there, and we see where she's at that point, and I want to kind of bring her to it in writing. But have I done it? No, I have an outline that's partially written. I stink.
Well, would you have wanted to see, because there was a, and this is somewhat tangential, but there was a part in the Mars when Michael and Steven go to rescue Sheridan, they put on their old uniforms. And it's kind of like, oh my God, that is what they look. It's kind of cool, you know, to see, Garibaldi now bald in that security gray again. And it's because we haven't seen him in like a season and a half in those uniforms. And so it's kind of cool. Would you have wanted to see Susan one more time in the Earth Force Blues with her captain's rank? Like, would it have been kind of cool to kind of see her the promotion?
I don't know if I care.
Okay.
Sorry. I feel like seeing Garibaldi and Franklin in those old uniforms was enough of a throwback, I guess.
But yeah, I think it would also be a little awkward to be Susan, because she's still in the Earth Alliance, or, you know, I guess she was broken away, but now she's back again to Earth.
Well, yeah, there's that whole thing, too. I mean, she has basically like a full pardon via Sheridan, but how is life settling back into, I don't know, being a member of Earth Force now that the war is over? Is that good? Does she have mixed feelings? We didn't get to explore that at all, and that's kind of a shame.
And then, of course, this isn't a spoiler, because she's on a captain of a deep space, so she's not going to be commander of Babylon 5, presumably. So that's kind of like, you can't get that, like, well, maybe she could have gotten her time. But anyway.
I know. That would have been the next logical step, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in a way, I really do wish that would have happened, but we could discuss that when we do season 5.
So, with Susan and Marcus, but what we, of course, have is the end of the Earth Civil War with Sheridan on the Agamemnon.
Yes, at Ivanova's request, he commands the last battle from the Agamemnon, his old ship. And for those who complained that the Shadow War didn't have enough pew-pew-pew, well, here it is.
Yeah, lots of pew-pew-pew. We get a bunch of battles with the Earth. We get
the
Mars battle. We get the Earth. Well, it wasn't really a battle per se with the Earth, but with the defense system.
The defense grid?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of explosions. There's a lot of possible sacrifice going on, and you kind of know at the 11th hour that somebody's going to swoop in and save Sheridan's butt, but it's still a great moment.
So the, I don't know, we haven't talked about it, and I'm not saying we have to talk about it, but at least for a minute.
Sure.
The use of the telepaths.
Oh, yeah, we really do need to discuss this, because this is a big thing. We've seen this thread throughout basically the whole season, from Franklin manipulating the telepaths to Leta working with this whole thing into executing it, and ethically speaking, did you think it was right?
See, I think that's what you have to come down to. It's not, I mean, because it's cool and it's all that. But when you come down to it, is it ethical to use people as weapons? Presumably against their choice, because they don't know better.
They're not really aware.
And you're killing them. I mean, because presumably the ship that you're attack them on is going to kill them because they want to get control of their ship back. You know, presumably every Earth ship killed all those telepaths to get control back of their ship.
Right. But with basically shadow technology implanted into their brains, are they already dead inside anyway, a la Anna?
Right.
So,
yeah.
I mean, it's a very fine line, and I'm glad that there was some disagreement as to whether that was okay or not. And we saw Franklin, I think, struggle with this.
Not enough, I would say. But yes,
well,
we did see him struggle.
He second-guessed.
Yes.
We are playing with people's lives here. However, like Sheridan, he ultimately came to the conclusion that this is for the greater good, and sacrificing 30 lives saves possibly 30 million or whatever.
During the Mars scene, I think that actress they had was not the greatest one. She's kind of like, what? Those are people.
Oh, yeah. My God. You're using them. She was a little overzealous.
Over the top. Yeah.
Yeah, it's all right, though.
But, yeah, let's try it again. This time, give me about a 5 on that 10.
I mean, but it is a good line because she's making a valid point.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a little over dramatically delivered. That's all right, though. I mean, maybe it was just the shock, and she's under stress. I mean, this is war.
Yeah, and you sort of have the Hitlerian, if I'm allowed to use that term, end of Clark, you know, in the bunker, shooting himself.
Yes.
Now, the scorched earth... I mean, it makes for a great edge-of-your-seat action. Does it make sense that Clark would do that? I mean, maybe you're supposed to say Clark's crazy, nothing makes sense. But, I mean, he's not crazy. I mean, he's, you know, diabolical.
I mean, he is the bad guy. We can make him as crazy as we want.
I guess. It just seems weird, like, F everyone.
Well,
okay.
Yeah, that's. I think that was kind of it. It's like, if I don't get my way, everybody else is going to go down with me.
Right.
But, I mean, consider a couple of things. I mean, he did kill President Santiago so that he could rise to power. This is not a nice guy.
Char, you've watched House of Cards, okay?
It's true. Are you saying, okay, is he better or worse than Frank Underwood?
You tell me now if we're really going to get to it.
It's pretty tough. I mean, we don't get to see President Clark speak to the camera about his real intentions very often. So it's a little tough. I mean, we get that little piece of footage where he says, oh, I can't wait to kill Santiago and get this little bastard out of my way. That's about it. We know that he's a bad guy.
Would you have preferred if he pushed Santiago into the metro? would that have been better for you?
It makes for good drama, I will say that, but...
If he had a cool wife, would that have helped you, you know?
Yeah, we don't know if he had a cool wife.
Yeah, I don't...
He might have had his very own Claire, but what happened to her? I'm guessing he didn't, because she wasn't there.
No.
He might have gotten further if he had a good wife,
there
like Claire.
There you go. That's right. So he wasn't evil enough, is what you're saying.
You know, two brains are better than one sometimes, I'm just saying. But he made his own bed. He deserved to die. Good. Go away. Mm-hmm. Be done.
Again, this is me. No one cares but me. But I'm kind of like, when they have, like, the acting president, I'm like, okay, how did that happen? Like, theoretically...
It happens quickly, doesn't it?
Well, I'm sort of like, this is me. I know, I'm the only one who's thinking of these things. There has to be a constitution in the Earth Alliance. There has to be a line of succession. You know, Battlestar Galactica, this. You know, it's the secretary of whatever is now the acting... You know, it's just sort of like this random senator from Russia is now acting president. I'm like, okay,
well,
whatever.
I don't think it was very well explained, but if you are thinking chain of command, maybe she was somehow the next in line. But on that same token, does that make her a bad guy if she's serving President Clark? Or did we skip something?
Disband the Senate or something? Or yeah.
I mean, in my mind, what happens, I make a leap where all of Clark's bad, evil people that he held really close to him, they're all gone. They've been weeded out by the good guys at this point. Lutsenko is the first one in line left.
Right.
That's what happened. That's how I rationalize that.
Because she comes across good. I mean, she makes some kind of, like, bitchy remarks, but whatever. I get where she's coming from.
Well, she's a politician.
Yeah, and I get where she's coming from.
Yeah,
you know.
She's got to be matter of fact about it, but she is, I mean, she's doing her job. That's how I see it.
The thing we always have to remember, us coming from the Sheridan hero standpoint, if you're on Earth, I don't know what the people of Earth think, or the Earth Alliance, however you want to find it. You know, do they think, oh, yeah, Clark's terrible. Man, I'm so glad someone got rid of him. Or like, I agreed with what some of you said. I don't think we needed to, like, kill everyone about it. And so I think the acting president has to thread that needle of, like,
yes.
And I don't know, was it, so I think, like, to the American Civil War, where, you know, it wasn't 50-50, it was kind of like 30-30 and then 40%, like, I don't really care. Which, I mean, we want to think that all these civil wars are great moral struggles, where people are just, like, you know, living their lives, not wanting to have war. For better or for ill, you know, something you're worth fighting for.
Yeah, you kind of have the people, like, they're caught in the middle. They're just trying to live their lives.
Yeah.
I think that is a lot of people in this conflict, where they want to stay out of harm's way. They don't necessarily like what's happening, but they're not going to actively fight it. But then you've got the fraction of people who are resisting effectively, and then you've got the people who are on the side of a totalitarian government and think it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
They're going with it. So, I mean, I think that's kind of how you get into these situations anyway, is you have that chunk in the middle who doesn't do anything.
Right. And it's one of the things, you know, I mean, I don't know, that's a separate podcast of like, can you blame them? Because I think there's ways, yes, oh, it's wrong, they should have known. But then it's like, well, did they know? Then even there's a shadow war going on. How, maybe they never even knew what Clark was doing. And maybe they, you know, maybe it's because they chose not to know. I don't know.
Well, I think, yeah, again, it's a little bit of both, yeah. Where they've been fed a lot of propaganda if you're watching ISN. But also, on the other hand, there's probably just as many people out there who think they know
yeah.
that that's fake news.
Yeah.
And they don't really know what's going on because they have access to only so much information because of the jammers.
Yeah, and I think, and we don't have to get to this now, but like, you know, I think of like World War II in Germany, and it's like the Germans, like the regular Germans, I'm not saying like the non-people that were in Nazi uniforms, the Germans were like, mm-hmm. how much did they know? And like, well, how could you not know? And we sort of get into that discussion. But yeah, and I think it's all very interesting.
Yeah, I think in hindsight, it's easy for us to look back and say, how could you not know what was going on? Well, I think living in the moment is very different than looking back in the history books. And look at what's happening right now
mm-hmm.
in our world. Need I say more right now?
Sure, it's going fine. I've been paid $5 a week to wear this armband. All I got to do is just look out for my neighbors. It's not a big deal.
Oh, God. You saw where that got Zach, didn't you? I mean, we did do last season. You better watch your back there, Gilfus.
So speaking of the moment with the acting president, of course, we get this moment where she kind of lays it in line with Sheridan. Because, you know, Clark's dead. Hurrah. But it's sort of that now it's the hard moment. Now, what does this mean? Picking up the pieces.
Right. We got to clean up the mess, and there's a lot.
Right. And so the first, you know, it seems to be priority number one. I don't know whether it should be or not. But what do you do with Sheridan? The Earth government asks itself. Okay, well, yes, Sheridan, fine. Maybe you did good. We'll concede that Clark's terrible and gone. And so fine. We're happy we're here, I suppose. But you're inconvenient. We can't reward you by keeping you as a captain in Earth Force back on Babylon 5 like nothing happened.
Right. So do you think that was kind of a fair punishment that he had to resign his commission? Because of how he did things, he did it the inconvenient way.
Right. Well, I mean, I think the way they come to him, that's where I say I understand how she says it. Maybe not how she said it, but like, we'd prefer if you resigned. Because she threatens to, but basically we're not going to court martial you because we're going to look like idiots. But it would help
but
us.
But we will if yeah. you say no.
Right.
Because that's what we're going to have to do.
And she offers, you know, all these, I mean, you know, that you can't. Yes, we'll give free, you know, allow...
Amnesty,
thank you. We're going to give amnesty to all your officers. Everything's on the table. They're just saying it would be better if you disappeared quietly.
Right.
Go write
yeah,
your book.
I mean, she does make it a very attractive proposition where if he doesn't agree to resign, then he and his crew all are going to get court-martialed, probably publicly dishonored, all of that. She's giving him the better choice. For sure. She's giving him an out.
You actually have to have, and not to make this so American, but you have to have Reconstruction, basically. It's very awkward after Civil War. You have to bring it
sure.
together. And what do? Because you're going to have people who fought against both sides. You just purge all the people who are on one side or the other. You know, what do? And so I think him being such a divisive figure, it kind of helps not to have him there. I mean, I'm not necessarily
yeah.
going to agree with it. I'm just sort of giving their point of view. Whether I agree or not, I have to think about it. But anyway, but I think that, of course, you have that awesome part. Where it's like, oh, I agree. Can I get it in writing? Okay. And I guess you're right. I guess I'll just fade away. And then it's like sitting down with this new alien alliance. Oh, okay. Well, who do I deal with? Well, we have our president too. Oh, really? Who is your president? Sheridan!
Yes, it might have. It's sort of like those old Apple conferences where Steve Jobs would always say, oh, but wait, there's one more thing. And then, you knew this all along, didn't you, Sheridan?
Well,
and Sheridan is so cool about
yeah,
it. He's like,
legs on the table.
Hey, you know, if I could stay in Earth Force, that was fine. If they wanted to elect me president, that was also cool. And if not, I was going to retire. I win no matter what. Suck it.
Because then I think you have the first time it has to be that awkward. Well, there's two moments. One is where, like, he gets up and he's going to go to the door. And he's kind of like, to the general who has to open the door for him. And I think it's that general or whoever's the first person to say, Captain, Mr. President.
Yes, begrudgingly. So, yes.
So we have President John J. Sheridan of the Interstellar Alliance.
Yes, and ultimately, this is, I think, a very good fate for Sheridan because of the whole thing of unity. I do think it is a good thing that he resigns from Earth Force, but then he gets to go on to, I dare say, these bigger and better things of uniting the galaxy as we know it. Hot diggity, buddy. Score.
It does come a little hard and fast. And again, I know it's because we're like the last episode, but it's sort of like, here we are, the Interstellar Alliance. Everyone join up. And Earth's kind of like, okay, I mean, can we think about it? Give us a week.
Well, yeah, I would like to think that, say, if they'd carried this into the fifth season, we would have seen, I think, a lot more, oh, I don't know, thinking about it. It wouldn't have just been where there's a speech and then, I don't know about you, but if I were on Earth and those white stars are shaking the ground, I'd be like, I would have the daylight scared out of me. I'm not sure if that was maybe the best move. I like it for dramatic purposes, but for a world that's recovering from a civil war and it's just starting, this might have not been the best move, but it does show off their power. And yes, we are a force and we can help you if you join us. And I don't know, in a way I almost feel like Earth is threatened into it.
Yeah, and because, I mean, they just came from a civil war. Let them breathe for a second. Let them get, you know, reorganized. And then maybe like a month later we can think of, we don't even know who's in charge really, so.
Right, I mean, yeah, I mean, she's acting President Lushenko. She's got to worry about elections coming up soon and all that. This is the part of the story that I feel is really rushed. For obvious reason, though. I mean, if this was going to be the end of it, you're going to go out with an explosive bang, and this is about as bang can get.
So, speaking of rushing, John and Dylan getting married.
And we didn't even get to see the freaking marriage, which really bummed me out.
Yeah,
which, and I guess we are not the only people bummed about that. The costume designers, when they found out that they were not actually going to even show a clip of the wedding, were so bummed because they wanted to design Delenn's wedding dress. They were so stoked, like, ooh, we get to get all fancy, and then, nope, not even going to happen. Sad, sad, sad. We don't get to see a clip on ISN or anything. And, I mean, they don't even really get much of a honeymoon. Spoiler alert.
Yeah.
You know, they're sleeping, sort of, on the White Star.
Yeah.
And then, cut two, they're heading back to Babylon 5. That's it.
And then they go to Babylon 5. They get the big greeting, welcome home. And it's interesting, because John now has the beard. He's president. He's a civilian, right, now. So it's also a good question. Who's in charge of Babylon 5 right now, by the way? Because Susan's gone on her ship.
I think Corwin, I think.
So, yeah. But anyway, I think Delenn was in charge of it at one point, which doesn't make sense at all. So, but then you sort of have, and that's, for argument's sake, that's where the season ends, in that time period of the couple's home. Garibaldi has joined the fold again.
Yeah, and that's another thing I felt might have happened a little too fast. Like, I really kind of wanted John and Michael to maybe hug it out and talk it out a little bit. Mm-hmm. But again, can't do everything, so we have to just get the plot points moving, and that's about it. But in my mind, that totally happened, because they're friendly again.
And also, I love this, because again, this is the last episode, and Veer's like, oh, by the way, Londo, funny story, I just got your emperor now.
Oh, yeah, and by the way. Yes, yes. One thing I must know, I kind of lost a little bit of respect for Jakar with this moment, although it is in character. The whole thing where he's using that artificial eye to spy on Sheridan and Delenn on their first night together as a married couple. You perv.
Now, Jakar is a perv, though. That has been established.
That is it, though. He is, but we haven't seen this side of him in a long time. He's more enlightened now.
Yeah, that's the argument. He's reformed now. He's not having...
No,
like,
he's not, apparently.
Three human prostitutes in his bed or something. But, yeah.
But, yeah.
That happens.
Gross. And then, like, how does he retrieve the eye later? How does he get in there?
Mm-hmm.
Like, really, you have to think about the logistics of this. How did he do that?
I don't know.
Jakar, you sicko.
So that's it. I mean, we're going to talk about the other thing. But, like, so as far as, I mean, that's sort of how it ends. And And like you said, if that's how it ended, yeah. It's slightly anticlimactic, but not really. I mean, you have the Interstellar Alliance, you have President Scherer, they're married. Huzzah. Mm-hmm. You know, huzzah.
Yeah. I mean, happy ending, right? And then had we ended actually at season four, we would have had Sleeping in Light, which was shot at the end of season four because they were that ready to be done with it if they had to be. Mm-hmm. And when you see that episode, boy, you know,
yeah.
That is the epic of all series finales. But JMS himself, he said he would have been really happy had this been the end of it. He says, if this had been it, I would have walked away with a great big smile and a full heart. That's a quote from Lurker's Guide.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I kind of feel like this has some parallels to Breaking Bad in a way, where season four of Breaking Bad to me felt really explosive in the action, and then the season five for both shows is sort of, it feels a little more like an epilogue. Things slow down.
Mm-hmm.
It's not as action oriented. There's still story to tell, but it does change its tempo a little bit.
Right. And I don't know, even if you want to talk about it, the last episode, there's a part of me that enjoys it because I enjoy, as someone who likes the world of government, the chat shows, the talking heads, the deconstruction. I mean, obviously it's in the whole title of how things happen and as history turns. And I can certainly see it, not necessarily even today. I mean, I can see it today, but you can even go back decades ago and how they talked about historical events. 50, you know, this has been happening all the time. It's nothing new under the sun. So I think it's fascinating in that respect to see our heroes in, you know, how this happens, you know, 100, 500, 1,000 years in the future.
Yeah.
My wife hated this episode.
Did she really? Well, it is a bit of an oddball, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they shot it in lieu of Sleeping in Light when, at the 11th hour,
mm-hmm.
TNT picked up Babylon 5 for its fifth season and those movies that we're going to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
So they shot this, and it's one of those things where it does feel a little bit out of place. I mean, it serves an interesting purpose, though. We kind of get this strange story of the rise and fall of human civilization and the Alliance. I mean, they built something that will last for 1,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
And we see that in action. We see kind of like monk rangers at one time.
After the Great Burn, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. We have fascism trying to take over and Garibaldi outsmarts them as a hologram, that's one of my favorite parts of it all. But, you know, I think in the end, it's sort of like a little...
Humans become Vorlons.
Yeah. We see the evolution. We see it all come full circle where the sun's going to burn out. As Sinclair said long, long ago, we do not lose Marilyn Monroe and Butch Cassidy and all of that because everything is preserved in the archive with our Vorlon human...
Yes.
Dude.
By the way, the encounter suit was scary. Like, if they had showed, like, an actual, like, Vorlon encounter suit, I'd have been like, okay, yeah. But, like, the, like, robotic, boom, I am, you know, and I was like, that is the craziest looking thing. I would have hoped we had a better design in 1,000 years for encounter suits than that, but.
They've evolved.
Yeah. Beyond the aesthetic.
Yeah, I can see why your wife didn't really care for it, though, because it's... It's not necessary viewing, for one thing.
Yeah.
But it's just, it's a very big departure from what we're used to seeing on Babylon 5. So I kind of want to do a quick poll, like, with our listeners.
Yeah.
I want you guys to comment on all the various social channels. Let us know, do you love this episode? Do you hate this episode? Are you ambivalent about it? Is it just there? I think for me, it's just kind of there. Like, I'm not going to skip it, but I'm not in love with it either, but I don't hate it.
Mm-hmm. And so I think as we... anticipate season five and close on this awesome season four, you know, we've sort of said some things, but I think as you go into season five, the questions was, what happened with Ivanova? Okay, who's in charge of Babylon 5? What's going to happen with the Interstellar Alliance? Is Marcus really dead? I don't think that's a real question, but my wife is like, he really comes back, right? Right, right, right?
Oh, your poor wife.
I know. But anyway, I think these are sort of like season four, so like boom, 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 everything's done. And you're kind of like, you can see there's more story. I mean, there's definitely, you know, Interstellar Alliance, Alanda becoming emperor.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of questions left to be answered.
Yeah.
What's going to happen with the telepaths?
Mm-hmm.
What's going to eventually happen when everybody kind of leaves Babylon 5 for their new postings?
Yeah,
because we're going to have this massive turnover and shift.
Mm-hmm. So, but I think, yeah, so that's what's to come. And we will answer that question with season five.
Yes. So now we get to go on and go through this season. So in the meantime, though, guys, we do want to remind you to go on all the various channels for the Nerd Party. You can find us on Twitter at @JoinNerdParty. Go to Facebook.com/TheNerdParty. Let us know what you think about Babylon 5. Talk to us about Babylon 5. Let us know what you thought about season 4. I mean, are you happy with it as it is? Like, do you skip season 5? Are you not excited about us going into season 5? Tell us everything. We want to hear. So until next time, guys, this has been the Voice of the Resistance.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.
Welcome to Nerd Party.